We originally published 15 of Dominic Rouse's images in Lenswork number 36 in July of 2001. In this Lenswork Extended number 69 portfolio, we revisit his work and include those original 15 images, plus an additional 39 images that show his artistic growth into more complex compositions and a more refined mastery of his unique craft. Well, I want to start with this business about what it is that you do, because it is a very interesting form of work, but I would have to say that I don't think that you photograph things, although you clearly do, and you clearly use photographs. It looks to me like you make images, or perhaps I should say you reveal images, and the images that you reveal certainly have photographic components, but it's you're making your own definitions, and I think that's absolutely fascinating. Tell us about that aspect, your process, and what it is that you perceive that you're doing.
Right. Well, that's a very good question. It's also a question I ask myself many times over. But really, the genesis of these images came many, many years ago, and I have the sketch pads to prove that. And for reasons that I cannot explain, I had images or ideas for images floating around in my tiny mind, which I simply was not able to do photographically prior to, if you like, the digital domain becoming affordable to one-man bands like myself. Mm-hmm. So I mean, as a photographer, I often say that I'm actually really more interested in, if you like, painting or artists than photographers. So I see very much the process of the making the images in the way that I do much more akin, although I'm using everything which is photographic. I'm sort of painting with photographs, if you like. But what I would say is I would describe the process as this, that what the digital domain has allowed or has given is a painter's freedom to photographers. So we can now produce images of imagination, which I know Jerry Ulven would contend this, but which really now, before, I think, were really not available to us. Well, certainly not to the degree of accuracy that we can now. Does that make sense?
Actually, it does. And I was pleased that you mentioned Jerry Ulven, because obviously, from the photographic perspective, when we look at this work, he, or possibly Magritte, the surrealistic painters come to mind. But I have to be honest, when I look at your work, I think you're doing something that's far more interesting than Ulven for my tastes. Not that it's a comparison or a contest by any means, but it's as though you're going a little bit farther than Ulven went, because your images are so heavily constructed. They're much, much closer, in my way of thinking, to the surrealistic painters, and in that sense, they're much more imaginative because they're much more complex.
Well, I think again, I would go back. I can't speak for Jerry as to how he thinks before he composes an image, but I would say that the difference between the technical difference between putting an image together in the computer and putting them together as I know he does is that There's a greater degree of possibility. There are more possibilities in the computer than there are within the analog multi and larger multi-negative route, because there are technical limitations within the darkroom which don't exist within the computer.
Right.
So I can afford to be more complex. And as I go along, as I hopefully improve my compositing skills, if you like, then there is an overwhelming desire to become ever more complex and to put ever more numbers of images into one image. And I thoroughly enjoy that. I mean, it's a challenge. And again, it comes back to, I think, if you like, a comparison to painting, that a painter with imagination really has no limitations upon the images that he can produce other than his imagination.
Right. And one of the things that that complexity allows you to do is to make images that look more realistic because they're more detailed. There's more subtlety. There's more shading. There's more subtle details, complexities, levels, layers, perspective, etc. And as a result of that, even though they become more and more and more fanciful and flights of the imagination, they feel more and more realistic. And that is part of what makes them so interesting, is that they're clearly not real, but they look as though they could be.
Right. Well, that of course is one of the things I actually do. I do attempt to achieve, because if you see, for example, a 40x50 toned silver gelatin print, you know, psychologically you think, well, that is a photograph. For nearly 200 years now, we know what a black and white photograph looks like. But then on sort of second take, you look and you say, well, that simply cannot be. That's not possible for that to be a simple photograph, because it does not and cannot exist. So I do enjoy making improbable images. That's for sure. To make an image which, to make photographs of things which do not exist. I like that aspect of it, for sure. You mentioned the sort of the subtlety of toning, the shadow detail, etc. Well, that in itself it causes problems, because again, in the computer, if you think you can take an image and really blow it up, so you can go into almost, you know, you can go into, and sometimes I do, into every individual pixel. But then to retain all that detail that you kind of lovingly put in, particularly in the sort of shadow areas, and my images, I admit, you know, are quite dark, both in reality and perhaps from their sort of psychological aspect. But to retain all that detail is not easy. And one of the reasons why I went the silver gelatin route was because that is the process which most readily retains all that information. I tried really for 3 or 4 years to try and do a digital print. Now we're going back 10 years and things have vastly improved. But I there's no exaggeration to tell you that Hanger, for example, and the four images I did right at the very beginning, almost the day I got the computer, I started to shoot them, is that it took me 4 years to realize that I couldn't do this digitally. I had to go back to a negative. And when I saw the first silver gelatin in, I think it was either 2000 or 2001, no, 2000 it was. In other words, almost four years after I actually originally shot them, it was wonderful. I saw what I had been trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Well, another sort of aspect of all of this, of course, is that for people who are not savvy with computer-generated images, or as far as that goes, even the general public that's not savvy with fine art photography, they only know it from a snapshot point of view. I'm talking about non-fine art photographers, if you will. They're going to look at these images with that sense of wonder that follows all good artwork of how the heck did he do it. I'll never forget the time I was walking through the Art Institute of Chicago down the main hallway there, and they have a large display of suits of armor and whatnot, and swords and lots of artifacts from that era. And what was fascinating about it is you would look at the incredible detail that these things had and realize that they were made, you know, 500 years ago, and say there was absolutely no way they could do that back then, but clearly they did. So when we look at your photographs, we say there's absolutely no way a man can do this with a camera, but in fact you do.
Well, with a bit of help from software engineers or software programmers, of course. So let me take you very, very briefly through the process. Mostly I shoot all the elements. Occasionally I will grab them or buy them if I simply can't do it, or it's too time consuming, or I don't have the equipment to get the images that I want. But essentially I am shooting, and principally mainly on a Bronica SQA 6x6 roll film. though in the images you'll have some 35 millimeter, you'll have some 5x4, and even some 10.8 is in there. But essentially it's 120. And what I'm shooting on is color transparency material. And the reason that might sound a bit odd if I know I'm going to go to black and white, but principally the reason for that is that color transparency material, as I'm sure you are aware, scans a lot better than certainly black and white negative yes. material, which is not designed to be scanned. It's designed to be put in an enlarger and printed. And it has bonds and glues and buffers and God knows what in it, which appear as horrendous granularity when it is drum mm-hmm. scanned, which I have, you know, a rather expensive, I confess, Haltech drum scanner, which gives me very high resolution scans from my transparencies. And of course, even though you shoot in color, to turn it into black and white, as we all know now, is actually the press of a button. So once all the images are in, scanned, collated, etc., it's simply, you know, putting them together in, well, I was going to say in Photoshop, but I don't actually use Photoshop, and I use a piece of software called Imaginator.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which was made by, do you know it?
Yes.
A lot of people, it seemed to lose its way a bit. But back when I first bought my computer 10 years ago, I looked at Photoshop and I looked at the Imaginator, and the Imaginator was just so far ahead of it. I don't know. I haven't looked at Photoshop in the intervening years, so it has probably improved. But there was a subtlety about Imaginator which Photoshop didn't have. And it worked. It's laid out, it's set out much more in a style, if you like, that I, as an old 10.8, you know, studio commercial photographer, understands. It's, there aren't confusing windows. You just get to work on the image. And it's lovely. It's a very, very nice piece of software. And essentially, you know, all the whistles and bells and special buttons that you get in programs like Photoshop, I don't need. I mm-hmm. don't really want to change things too much from the transparency. What I want to do is to take all the numerous elements that I've got to put into my shot. I want to put them together as seamlessly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So just carrying on with the sort of technical side. So once all the elements are together and we have a final file, it's an RGB. Well, it's not TIFF in Dicamed, but it comes out as an RGB grayscale file. In other words, it doesn't go down to a single channel.
Mm-hmm.
I then send that off to my genius printer in London who gets it written to a black and white negative material, which is normally T-Max, so I think we've just changed to FB4. And I'm not absolutely certain, but I think the companies now are making film especially to be used in film recorders. In other words, to have digital files written to them. I'm sure there's different characteristic curves, etc., that need to be made for those peculiar right. circumstances. Right. But anyway, and once the negative is there, it's processed as normal and printed as per normal.
So it's essentially an LVT or...
Yes, that's correct. I think you guys call them LVTs. We call them film writers or film recorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you end up with, for all intents and purposes, a continuous tone 4x5 negative, which you can
Or 10.8. I'm just saying.
Or 10.8. Yes, yeah. And you can put that in an enlarger and make, for all Absolutely. Intents and purposes, a traditional gelatin silver print.
Absolutely. And but the only thing I think I would point out is that because of the controls that one has in the compositing and sort of file preparation stage within the computer, I actually believe that you can the purists would argue with me, but you can enhance the final file or the final negative in subtle ways that actually make it crisper and cleaner and clearer than a traditional negative made in a camera would be. But.
Well, certainly the argument could be made that all of the zone system tools that so many of us photographers have used for so long now all exist for the purpose of making a better negative that creates a better print or at least an easier print to make because we're matching the negative to the print material more perfectly. And essentially, you're Absolutely. Doing the same thing.
Of course. And I think I'd even go further than that because if you think of all the, I mean, we have all seen the Ansel Adams books which show the negative, the simple, direct, single exposure print, and then the print that he made, which with all the variations of exposure and dodging, etc. Well, of course, we now do all that in the computer. Mm-hmm. And the ability to control, you know, very, very small areas uniquely within a negative area, within the area of a composition, I mean, it's heaven.
Yeah.
It really is heaven. To be able to affect, to load your brush with just a slightly lighter tone and just to kiss in some light, if you like, put in a kiss of light, which, you know, having worked in the studio for years, to know that to do that with light itself would take forever.
Yeah.
It's a great way to work.
Well, so in a somewhat quick overview, that's what you're doing technically to create what you're creating. And it clearly works incredibly well for you because the images are lovely and quite both haunting and memorable and mesmerizing. But of more interest to me almost than the technology, because the technology is, well, I don't want to say it's getting old hat, but it's no longer cutting edge anymore. No. What's more interesting to me is the fact that what you're doing with this cutting edge technology is not something that is visually trite. Now, by that I mean when the Photoshop kinds of tools first came out, lots of people figured out, oh, I could make things float in the sky, you know, and that kind of stuff. And we saw lots of people experimenting with what the tool could do, but they weren't making very interesting artwork. Yours, if it were painted in the school of realism and everything was applied with horsehair single strand brushes, yes. Mm-hmm. They would be just as interesting as they are now as photographs, because what you're creating is being made with a camera and with a computer and with an enlarger, but the content of what you're doing is independent of those tools, even though those are the tools you use to make them. You're working in a tradition that is not a photographic tradition, but is a long artistic tradition going back to, oh heavens, you could think of Bosch and lots of people who have been doing this kind of work for 1,000 years.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Just you mentioned walking through, did you say the Chicago Institute and looking at the armor and uh-huh. the intricate work on it? Well, I don't know whether you've ever come across a book by David Hockney, the British artist, called, I believe it's called Just Secret History, in which it also was made into a television documentary, which was shown in the UK. But it traces what he believes is the, if you like, the role of the lens within the history of art.
Mm-hmm.
And he maintains he proves this to my satisfaction, that suddenly painters learnt to use the camera obscura, or learnt to use lenses and mirrors to make images. In other words, you know, from the medieval, you look at medieval paintings and they're very flat, they're very two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, almost overnight, they could paint the most amazing, intricate paintings. And one of the examples he gives is, in fact, of a piece of armor.
Interesting.
In which all that wonderful etching, presumably done by hand, you know, knocked in with a hammer or a mallet, and as a painting, and it looks like a photograph. And the reason it looks like a photograph is because it was first formed on a piece of canvas or on a piece of paper using a lens.
Uh-huh.
And another interesting thing, just as an aside, he actually says, well, to prove this, go and have a look at paintings throughout history and see how many left-handed people there are and how many left-handed monkeys. In other words, they were mirror images.
Right, right.
So I've wandered off away from your original question, I'm afraid, and I shall try and come back to it. And I think I can reiterate that what the computer, the digital domain has given us is a painter's freedom. So a lot of the photographs that we admire throughout history, they did not have the ability to make the images that we do now. They made the images that they had the ability to make, not just the intellectual ability, but of course the technical ability, that which was at their disposal. And I think if you look at the history of art, what artists do, art changes when the tools that artists can use change. One looks at Impressionism, and although that was, to an extent, a revolt against the sort of photographic revolution, it was also accomplished because they could put oil paints in little tubes and they could go out into the field. Whereas before, it had to be mixed up in the studio and was a very long, laborious process. So again, that's an example of how a tool affected images. And that's only what I see happening in the kind of work I'm trying to do. And I refer you again to the fact that I have these ideas and I don't know why. I can't tell you why I think like I do. I mean, is it possible to invent a mind? I think like I do. And I could not for 10 or 15 years. Literally, I had sketch pads of images that I could not make because there was not the technology to make them. And then I, like a blinding flash, I came across this software which was just about affordable, and I went ahead and started making them.
What you just said there, though, I think is the really interesting part, is that as an artist, you were not compelled to go look at the world and make an image that showed us the world.
No, that's not my interest.
You were compelled to look in your mind and show us the world that was in your mind.
Indeed.
And that almost defines the two poles of art making in some regards. There are those painters who paint the world and show us what the world looks like, and there's those painters who show us their mind. There's those musicians who make something that's very realistic. You know, here's music that is intended to simulate, a grand battle. And then here's something subtle that comes from the depths of the human mind that we can't even fathom. And absolutely, you're definitely in that end of the spectrum. And for photography, that's unusual.
I guess. But again, going back to, if we don't look at the history of art as divided, as separate from the history of photography, then there really should be no alarm, let's put it that way, because it's just a natural progression. Photography, if you like, has caught up with the other visual arts, painting in particular.
Absolutely.
But going back to what you said, yes, I'm much, much, much more interested in the mechanism of the mind, which, of course, however long we live, we shall never understand, but it's a fascinating instrument, and I think one should utilize it. I mean, there are wonderful photographers, and you show them regularly in lens work, who can capture superbly well this world, what it looks like and beyond. I can't compete, and I don't have any inclination to. I think the way I was asked recently, how would I sort of encapsulate my career? Well, I started out as a press photographer, believe it or not. And, of course, as a press photographer, you essentially capture the world that is around you.
Uh-huh.
And it has evolved over the years, through many twists and turns, into a stage now where I am attempting to create, if you like, a world of my own, or to visualize the world that is my own.
Yes, and in that regard, it's a world that only you can create or make, because you are the only one who has access to your individual mind.
Indeed. I hope so.
Where lots of photographers can go photograph, to document some political event or whatever the case may be.
Of course. It's kind of interesting when I'm shooting, for example, if I'm shooting a temple, a Buddhist temple, I mean, they're beautiful. But often I find myself off in some rotten little corner looking at something which most people completely ignore. And it seems to me that's often more fascinating than the obvious. There is beauty in the obscene almost. You have to have an appreciation of the obscene. I'm using the obscene in its sort of medieval definition, but you almost have to have an appreciation of the obscene to really see beauty.
Yeah, I once asked Jerry Yulsman what he did with the camera, and he said quite honestly he used the camera more to gather raw material because the camera was not where he visualized the creative aspects of his life to be. It was more just gathering, and the creative aspect took place back in the darkroom. I suspect the same could be said for your work.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right there, Brooks. It is that. And having spent, many, many years of my life in a studio, tungsten lighting, 10-8 transparency shoots. The way that I'm working now is frightening, because I know that I'm just garnering and I'm not taking the care that I would have taken years ago. And often, for example, if I photograph somebody, the background is pretty unimportant because it ain't going to be there when I finished.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way I would describe a transparency, each of those transparencies, is a rough sketch.
Mm-hmm.
It's the artist's rough sketch. You know, you've seen sort of Leonardo's studies of hands, etc., and then you go and look at the finished masterpiece. Essentially, they're different beasts, but you can see how the journey went from that charcoal or pencil sketch to the finished beauty. And that's how I see the transparency now, as far from being the finished, well, it's not the finished product. It was before, but now it is a sketch.
And when we look at your work, we don't feel like we're looking at the world. It very definitely has, for me, the feeling that somehow you have pulled back the curtain and I'm peering, as it were, inside your mind, which is... It's a strange experience, quite honestly, as a viewer, partly because the images are what the images are, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, but partly because the idea that I'm looking inside the private recesses of your mind is a little bit invasive. You know, it's like, am I supposed to be looking at this? I have a little bit of a voyeuristic feeling when I look at these images.
Yeah, I think... One always puts up barriers, so they are not as honest, perhaps, as perhaps they should be or could be. I mean, the image acts as a barrier, does it not, between us and the real world, like our imagination, like our fantasies, if you like. Mm-hmm. They're a sort of a halfway house. But it's sadness. I don't know why it is, but sadness seems to trigger in me the impulse to make images. One of the reasons why I don't think that they will ever be used in sort of advertising is because they are not happy images. They tend to be dolorous. They tend to be a little bit doleful. And it is the sadder aspects of human nature which interest me and get my mind a-wandering.
Yeah. Well, they're all, as you mentioned earlier, a little bit dark, both from an illumination point of view and from a psychological point of view. I'm assuming you're obviously comfortable with creating those images or you wouldn't be doing it. Comfortable in the sense that you're sharing them with all of us or you wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, I have no worries about that whatsoever. I mean... Ultimately, what one is hoping to achieve is, you know, an interesting image at its most basic, a powerful image, an image which has impact, creates interest. But surely what art should do is show the viewer something perhaps that he has not seen before, which then prompts him to ask questions. I mean, Picasso said about computers, he said, computers are useless. All they can give you is answers, or are answers.
Mm-hmm.
It's the questions in art which are the most interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have not lived before. I will not live again. If you like, one is trying to leave sort of a fabric or a pattern of oneself on the fabric of whatever this is, whether it's a dream or reality or whatever. But it seems to me such a waste not to use the imagination. There is a wonderful book which I come back to over and over again, written by an Englishman called Colin Wilson. It was released, I think, and published in 1956. It's called The Outsider, and it's the definitive study of alienation, creativity, and the modern mind. And it really is absorbing. But one of the things he says in there is that the imagination is the instrument of self-knowledge, which I think is so true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's almost as if you can't control your imagination.
Yeah. How do you respond to the observation that a lot of your images carry a similar theme, that is to say, the headless woman, in particular the naked headless woman, that obviously has to be something that has come up in other conversations before. And since these are essentially psychological projections or explorations of your own psychology, that theme must be quite meaningful.
Well, yes and no, in the sense that I can honestly say to you that I couldn't write, I don't think I could write a sentence or a few sentences which would explain explicitly, precisely why that figurine has appeared, not only so prominently, but appeared at all.
Uh-huh.
But the closest I can come to it is this phrase, the imposition of absence. Now, I don't know how far I want to go down this route, but it's certainly, it is certainly related to childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And my childhood in particular, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons that I make the images, they're curative.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost, yes, they are curative. They are a release. I mean, for example, when people have difficult experiences, often, especially young people, they're often encouraged to make pictures or paintings or draw or express themselves in writing or whatever, to kind of, as a catharsis, to get it out of the system. And these, albeit after a very, very long time, I would say are a reaction to a lot of the emotions, or to the emotions engendered in my childhood, which I had not fully dealt with.
Well, and I suppose if you could express it verbally, you might be tempted to. I mean, there's always poetry, there's writing, there's journals, there's et cetera. Maybe for you, this visual tool that you've discovered, this way of expressing yourself, is the best way that you can express whatever it is that can't be expressed in words. We have to just look at the images.
Indeed. Well, and a lot of my stimuli for these images come from, you know, from my readings, from poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I certainly have some of the images, the titles are titles of poems that I have read and which have moved me or touched me in a way or struck a chord that have helped me to then bring, you know, an image to fruition, if you like. But I do keep a journal as such. I do. I walk around everywhere with a little digital recorder, which I speak into, and then I record them in the computer. I log them in. I put them into a database. And I occasionally go back and sort of read through it, and I can see a progression. But it's not really it doesn't at first sight seem particularly relevant to the image-making process, but it is. It is there. It's more how I think, how I'm thinking at that given time, not necessarily about the image that I am working on per se at that given time.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in looking at photography relative to art history that you mentioned earlier is that a lot of the same themes show up in art history, and by that I mean our relationship with each other, our relationship to our own mortality, to the life is suffering. Who am I?
The big
what
questions.
Is God? You know, all of these kinds of things. And yet, sometimes when I look at the history of photography, it seems to be something completely different than those kinds of questions. But yet, you've been able to cross into that area. And that's another thing that I think is so compelling about your photographs, is that I don't think I'm looking at some people disparagingly say, another rock, another tree. These are deeper issues that you're exploring.
And I think, I hope that you are right. You know, I hope I am doing that. I hope I'm honestly searching through some of the questions that you just outlined, which, you know, as I said then, that they are the big questions. And surely, even the dullest of human beings at some point considers them. It seems to me it is not possible to live and not ever concern yourself, for example, with your death, which is the one inevitability of life. And so, you know, the books that I read, the stuff that I read, deals with those kind of issues, and they are the ones that preoccupy my mind at the times when I'm sitting around and thinking, for sure. I mean, I love Nietzsche. Now, you couldn't get a deeper man than Nietzsche. I mean, it's wonderful stuff. And I think one page of Nietzsche could keep me going in images for the rest of my photographic life. I mean, it's wonderful stuff.
Yes, but it's not, what's the term I'm looking, oh, I know, you said it this way. I think you said it's not the duty of art to be acceptable to polite society. I think I remember a quote along those lines.
I have just revamped or trying to, I'm in the process of trying to write an artist statement which is acceptable to me and hopefully understandable to others. And that is certainly one of the comments, the sentences that I've written in the current one, which is up on the website, and which I consider to be the first draft, frankly. But even so, that is a reflection of, it's a re-quoting, a reworking of something that Oscar Wilde wrote in his introduction to, now, The Picture of Dorian Gray, that's correct, which I don't know whether you know it, it's the perfect apologia for the artist, if you ask my opinion. It is beautiful. And of course, as you know, Oscar had his detractors. Uh-huh. And he's right. He said it's not the duty of the artist to produce work that is acceptable. It's the duty of the public to become more artistic. In other words, I think what he's saying is, you know, to open your minds more to the possibilities that you have not yet considered. And I think often when we see something which we haven't seen before, we are kind of shocked by it and we revile against it as the mass of humanity. And you look through the history of art at artworks which have been reviled, which are now, you know, accepted without question. And what it is, it's the shock of the new. And I think what I would say is that it's our duty to, if you like, to be more sympathetic to the artist and just try and see perhaps that he has seen something that we have missed.
Yeah, it's difficult, though, don't you agree, that to be the guy at the pleasant social dinner who says, oh, yes, the food is lovely, but we'll all soon be, you know, dead, buried, and rotting flesh.
That's not the time to do it.
Well, okay, perhaps. But as an artist, that's essentially what the task is with the kinds of images that you're doing, is to bring out these aspects of all of our lives, whether it's mortality, whether it's pain, whether it's you know, any of the so-called negative aspects of life. You're exploring those and sort of bringing them right up for us to see in a way that is a bit confrontational, a bit challenging, but ultimately, you know, quite a health-inducing sort of experience.
I was going to say that a confrontation or a challenge is no bad thing sometimes.
Yes, agreed.
But I think I would use the words, if I may, of Martin Luther, who said, you know, I can do no other. I mean, it's not right. As if, okay, this may sound a little pompous, but let me say that. It's not as if I choose to make the images that I do. Of course, there is choice in making them, but I would far rather it be thought that they kind of choose me to get made because, you know, it's my work, I'm the closest one to it, that there's no other way of getting them done.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
And yes.
I don't, my consideration, what you just read about, you know, or just read out, quoting me about the polite society, it's not that I deliberately set out to make images which upset people. I genuinely don't. I deliberately set out to make images that I think are interesting, that interest me and are pertinent to me. And, you know, friends of mine have said, well, you know, that's very nice, Dominic, but who on earth would hang that on their wall? And it's a very fair question.
Well, yes, but there's a difference between a strategy used by a pop culture artist who says, let's find that line that society says we should not cross and cross it so that we can get press and publicity and et cetera. And that is not at all what I see that you are doing in the least. So this is not a shock value kind of artwork that you're doing.
Well, I can assure you, had some pretty vehement criticism about some of the things, the images that I've made. But I don't see it myself. They don't shock me and they don't upset me. And I don't think you could ever describe them as vulgar or indecent. I just don't think you can, but there you go.
Well, again, if you weren't working in a long tradition from the art perspective, and that list of people who have done, at least in the world of painting, somewhat similar images, or shoot, we could always talk about the world of literature too. I'm not sure I would see anything different in your images that I see in Dante or that I see in the Sistine Chapel paintings. So we have to be realistic and say what you're doing maybe with a new tool, and for people who are conversant with the tool but not conversant with the art history behind it, they might say that's not photography, that's not what we should be doing, etc. But I don't think there's much merit in that criticism, quite honestly, because of the history that you can attest to in those artists who have gone before you.
I'm often put into the surrealist bracket, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I don't necessarily see all the work as surrealist, but I can see, and I certainly admire, the likes of Dali and Magritte, for sure, and Escher, who probably would come under that umbrella. But it seems to me that photography, because the starting point of photography is necessarily reality, you actually have to have something and put it in front of the lens, that if you attempt surrealism and if you achieve it, you might even say that the surrealistic poignancy is greater in photography than it can be in painting, because you know that in painting you can create anything.
True.
You know, you can put a carrot on a bottle, a wine bottle. You can do that. You can make a foot become a shoe, a boot. You can do that. You can paint it. It's straightforward if you have the imagination and the technical skill. It is obviously now possible to do that photographically, but I think it's still a little new. In time, as with all of these things, it will just seem very passé.
Ah, but you know what? The human heart, the human spirit, the human mind, those are not new, and the issues that you're exploring are issues that have plagued us since consciousness. And
well, yes.
And that's
why
it's interesting.
And long may consciousness continue.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you're... I mean, I like to think that I am dealing with serious subjects, though every now and then I do wander off, and I have a sense of humor, and I do try and get that injected into part or a picture or two. And that can often be seen in some of the titles.
Yeah, I guess my objective in focusing so much on this particular issue is because I suspect that there are a lot of photographers, some of whom are probably Lenswork readers, who will tend to look at this work and say, that's not a photograph. And that's okay for them to take that perspective. I'm hoping that they'll look at it a second time and realize that it really isn't a photograph like they've known, but it's a photograph that has a tradition that goes back in art history a long time. And you just happen to be doing it incredibly well in this day and age with new tools. And my suspicion is that your work will survive a long time because it's so interesting.
Well, that's very kind of you, and I hope that you are right. Yeah, what can I say? I mean, if people are generous enough to look at it in the perspective of art history, that would be wonderful. I mean, what could be better than to be taken seriously as an artist? There is, in my estimation, nothing better. Coming back to your comment about people might think, you know, this is not photography. Brooks, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I really don't. It doesn't seem to me that it matters how... for example, Leonardo painted. Does it matter which brushes he used?
Absolutely correct. Yeah.
Absolutely right. You know, the point is he got there. The question, you and I both know Art and Fear, the book Art and Fear, and there's those three fundamental questions that the guy's asking that. What is the artist trying to say? How does it go? What is the artist trying to say? Did he achieve it? And the third one, was it worth? Yeah, was it worth doing? So, you know, within that, those three questions, which I think, you know, they've encapsulated the problem of art wonderfully, technique doesn't really play a role, does it?
No, it doesn't. Although we are creatures of habit, we are creatures who tend to want to put things in nice little neat boxes. And it's always a pleasure to find an artist like you who says, what boxes? Let's go over here.
Well, again, it's very kind of you. And I'm not being evasive. I don't deliberately set out to do that. I mean, I can just say this. I started as a press photographer, and then I went into commercial stroke advertising photography. These images that we're discussing now have all been made in the last 6 years, and I'm 40, coming up for 48. I've been making images now for just over 30 years. So this is a very, you know, brief part of my career, and I hope that I never have to change lanes again. Let's put it like that. And I'm still coming to terms internally with the notion of being perceived as an artist, whereas in the past I was commissioned to go and photograph, you know, a man on top of a balloon or doing something stupid for the newspaper or a product for a brochure or a catalog for commercial photography. And so this notion of doing images solely to please oneself is still finding its place within me. And what I always did work which was uncommissioned. Always. It was like me practicing, if you like. And in the commercial world, we call that personal work. Mm-hmm. We don't see it as anything else other than, you know, perfecting a technique, perhaps getting some of the frustrations of working, you know, rigidly for clients out of our systems. We do work just for the joy of making an image. And that was occasional.
Mm-hmm.
But now it has become, if you like, perennial, I hope. So for me to elucidate clearly how I see myself within the work or how I see the work is still a little difficult for me. So if I'm being evasive or non-communicative, please forgive me. It's not as if I've been an artist for 30 years. I don't consider that.
Well, we first published you back in Lenswork number 36.
It was. It was number 36, and I believe it was July, August of 2001. And I started in earnest mid-2000 with these. So it's actually 7 years, isn't it?
And having originally published you back then with what was a very unique body of work, I can honestly say I'm quite thrilled that you've continued on this vein and that the work continues to, in my perspective anyway, for whatever it's worth, it's continued to mature, it's continued to evolve. It is not in the least gotten repetitive, which sometimes happens with photographers when they discover, as you say, a new lane. And I hope you keep working at it because I'm absolutely fascinated by what you're doing. And I hope we have another conversation in another half a dozen years or so to see what you've been doing more recently.
Well, that is inspiration enough to keep going. I'm really grateful to any encouragement because, you know, we need it. I mean, you know, it's often like working in the dark. You don't really know what you are doing a lot of the time. You know that it's enormously enjoyable. But how it will be judged, one never knows.
Yeah.
One never knows. And that's not the reason you do it. As I say, it's personal psychology, I would say, as much as anything else.
Well, thanks so much for doing it and for keeping us in mind and allowing us to share your work with the Lenswork readers again. I know from the emails I received back in 2001 that you've developed a number of fans amongst our readers, and they really appreciate your work, and I know they're going to enjoy seeing the new images that you've done since then. So thank you so much.
Not at all. My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Copyright 2007, Lenswork Publishing.